It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Rob Ferret. We're listening to Evil in the background by the Madison-based band Fox. The band went to high school together in Baraboo, Wisconsin, and they have been proclaimed by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel as Wisconsin's best chance at indie stardom.
And we were lucky enough to have Fox live on Central Time back in July, shortly after we launched the show. And they're playing in Austin, Texas now at the South by Southwest Music Festival this week. We're playing songs from bands representing Wisconsin throughout the show today. And here's a little more of Evil by Fox.
Coming up, a Milwaukee-based graphic designer is getting some attention nationally for his take on the hit TV show Mad Men, but taken from an African-American point of view.
First, this week is the third anniversary of Act 10 becoming law. The budget repair bill limited collective bargaining for public employees and touched off huge protests and ongoing court cases.
This week, we've been looking at the impact of Act 10 in Wisconsin with lawmakers, reporters, a local school official, and today, we look at how the law has affected unions. You can join the show, too, if you'd like, if you're a public employee or an administrator. How has Act 10 affected you? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, talk@WPR.org.
Frank Emsbach joins us now. He's managing editor and executive producer of Workers Independent News and emeritus professor of labor education at the School for Workers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Frank, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Well, we did have a nice day here in spite of the forecast, I guess, up there in Superior. That's good.
Sounds like a lot of snow, though. Well, I want to dig right in. We don't have you for too long. How has Act 10 changed the strength of unions in Wisconsin as you see it?
Well, it did what Governor Walker said it was going to do, which was to reduce their strength in some cases by considerable amounts, like 80%. So from a political point of view, which is what was discussed in the newspapers over the last week, the ability of unions to bring forth political activity is lessened. They have fewer members and hence not as much money coming in, even though you should know, and I think it's important, that dues money cannot be used specifically for politics. But still, if you're in a union, you generally tend to join the political organization they have. But yes, it's weakened unions considerably. And I think that was a clear and very, the governor expressed it quite clearly. And that's what he said he wanted to do, and that's what he did.
Now, you mentioned union membership is down. Let's look at that number. What is the status of union membership since the passage of Act 10?
Well, I think it depends on which union. The public school teachers, K through 12, in the Wisconsin Education Association Council, well over 60% recertified as they took votes and said, we want our union. And most of the people that did not were not K through 12 teachers. In the units represented state workers, in those cases, membership has dropped considerably, 60%, 70% or more, depending on the union. And so there's a difference there. And in some places, of course, the contracts still remain. And so, for instance, in Dane County, there's still a very, very high percentage of membership in AFSCME Local 60, Madison Teachers Incorporated. And so there, the contracts have been extended, I believe, through the end of this year and some into 2015. And other things are going to happen on July 1st when the law takes effect dealing with the hospital workers, which basically said they can't have any union whatever whatsoever at any time. And so as the contracts those workers have expire, once it expires around, I think, July 1st and the other at the end of the year, they lose their bargaining rights completely.
What kind of changes would you say that we've seen, given the picture you painted about a decreasing membership and diminished strength? How has that changed what happens in the workplace for these public employees?
Well, I think the workplace is the most important place to look. And what I see is this, and I say I see because we interview lots of people who are working about what it's like at work right now. First of all, you move from a situation of rights with a procedure should there be discipline or some problem, to discussion with no end. They don't have to do anything. And so what you see is in many workplaces you have a decent management, fair people and whatnot, but others you don't. And so there is no redress. And so that's the first thing you see. The second thing you see is in areas where there's been a lot of contracting out and privatization, where the people coming in are getting paid more than the state workers that are there. There's all kinds of friction and unrest. But one of the other things is that state workers in those positions are more reluctant to report on abuse. Why is that? Because if the boss who has just arranged for a contractor is now confronted by an employee who says, hey, this is really wrong, that employee has no recourse. And you have a situation sort of built in where you can see an increase in abuse and improper payments and this, that, and the other thing. And so I think that the absence of fairness, and I don't mean, you know, crazy stuff, but the absence of a legal procedure in the workplace means that it is possible. I would say maybe it leans in that direction, but we don't know yet, to have, unfairness and abuse. And that's the danger here, that there's not a countervailing administration or a countervailing set of laws that allow you to have adjudication as opposed to arguments, but, you know, that you actually have something that's enforceable. And that's the major difference in the workplace. Then, of course, there have been issues of wages and who is going to get the job and all that kind of stuff, and much more difficult to enforce health and safety standards.
Now, Governor Walker had said he wanted to use Act 10 to give local authorities the power to use different tools to help with their budgets. And if you look at some of the, you know, West Bend, for instance, that school district has said it's doing better. We had the superintendent on yesterday.
Right.
What about that trade-off? Is it worth it to have a little better budget outlook?
I listened to that interview, actually, before this one, and I didn't hear a new tool. What I heard is, teachers were very nervous. Teachers were very afraid. Oh, yes, a lot of our most senior teachers left. And what does that mean? That means that the tool was fear and people leaving their job and being replaced with lower seniority, lower paid teachers. Well, I don't think that's a particularly innovative management tool, number one. Number two, the other part he talked about was health. Well, I can't imagine that if the school district had gone to the union and said, hey, we have a less expensive health care that's more comprehensive, would you like it, that they would say no. So, again, I didn't hear any new management tools. I heard a replacement of higher-paid workers by lower-paid workers. And, again, you didn't need Act 10 to do that. And the question is that the right thing to do, given all the problems we have in education, to replace experienced teachers with inexperienced people? I don't see it. That's the first thing. Secondly, I think Act 10 did not, in and of itself, provide any new management tools, except you have unlimited and unchecked authority. And initially, that always works sometimes. You know, you could say, do this, and people have to do it. That doesn't mean that it's either new or innovative or the right thing to do, again, because you have no legally protected countervailing discussion.
I want to ask you, union leaders have said they're planning on playing an active role in this year's Wisconsin elections. How much clout do you think they have right now?
I have no idea. People put a tremendous amount of effort into the recall elections and to the both all types, the individual senators and representatives and the gubernatorial recall, and it came up short. I think that certainly people have the right and will be involved. The question really is, what are people running on, and what is the strength of the candidates? Unions or any organization, the environmentalists can put lots of money into the electoral arena, but if the candidates are not particularly strong or motivating, then it's not going to make much difference. So certainly, I'm sure they're going to spend what they can legally and encourage their members to vote. Clearly, people recognize in the public sector workforce what can happen if you don't vote.
Frank, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Frank Emsbach with Workers Independent News. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We continue our series of interviews on the impact of Act 10 3 years after it was signed into law. You can join in with your thoughts and stories if you're a public employee or a manager of public employees. How has Act 10 changed your workplace? Or perhaps you're a supporter of Act 10. As you look back over 3 years, is Act 10 doing what you hoped it would do? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, talk@WPR.org.
Jack Bernfeld joins us now. He's a WEAC representative who's worked with a number of public employee local unions for more than 30 years, recently with the Racine Teachers Union. He's now Uniserv Director for WEAC's Capital South region. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Jack, you were with the Racine Teachers Union after Act 10 when a new handbook replaced the old contracts. Can you tell us what that process was like?
That process was very collaborative. We had developed over the course of a decade a very strong working relationship with the school district, both the administrators and school board, as well as members of the community. And with the advent of Act 10, all decided that it was best to maintain the good cooperative relationship that we had developed despite the fact that the law gutted most of collective bargaining. And we engaged in a year-long process of reviewing each of the provisions of the collective bargaining agreements that had been in effect for decades and were the product of compromise and give and take over those years, and in that context developed a very good handbook.
So you're describing a collaborative process that was intended to be civil. Do you think that that experience was duplicated in other areas of the state, or is Racine unique?
Well, it occurred in some areas that I'm familiar with, but not in all. And where the parties chose to work collaboratively and where employees chose to respect and value the input of the teachers, their staff, and their unions, a good work came out of that, and a good work product that provided stability and predictability for employees and provided a good workplace so that these employees could attract new teachers. Where they didn't, of course, where fear was created, where districts used the effects of Act 10 to strip employees of their rights to create larger classes and longer work hours and to impose more testing regimens. The result is there was a lot of turnover. A lot of veteran teachers left, a lot of veteran staff left, and these school districts are left, I think, in a tough situation about providing the quality of education that we've come to expect in Wisconsin.
Now, yesterday we talked with school superintendent Ted Knightsey, who said Act 10 didn't bring down the doom and gloom that teachers had feared, and that, in fact, it helped improve schools for students and improve the budget outlook. What would you say to that?
Well, as I said, it varies. Where there's been a respectful relationship, where the role of the teachers and the union has been valued, when they've been seen as a partner, along with that of the community and others, then the situation has remained fairly positive. You haven't seen a great flight of veteran teachers and other staff leaving the district. But where they haven't, where they've imposed really rigorous and difficult conditions on employees and stripped employees of their rights to due process or just cause or stripped all vestiges of seniority, where they've extended hours and cut pay and cut insurance rights and benefits that had been long negotiated, then there is a lot of fear. Then employees are unhappy, and in many instances they're walking with their feet. They're leaving the districts and finding other places that will respect them and value their services.
I want to go to the phone lines right now. We've got a call here from Dan in Wausau. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I totally agree with your person that's talking. I work for a governmental agency, and I think the bad thing about Act 10 is the fact that the way they went about it, it showed a lack of respect for the people that are out there every day doing the jobs and delivering services, and I think it caused a great divide in the state. And that's what I guess I'm the most upset about. Power is an aphrodisiac, and it seemed like that once this administration got in, it was, we're going to win at all costs. I see the same thing happening now. I've been trying to find out what the debt is in Wisconsin, what we still owe. I'm struggling with the fact that we're willing to give millions of dollars back to people, and I believe there's a $4 billion debt yet, but I've called the governor's office twice, and I can't get an answer.
All right. Well, thank you, Dan, for your thoughts there. Dan describing what he sees as a lack of respect and the creation of divisions. Do you still see those divisions today, Jack?
We do. They're very evident. I mean, the law is still relatively new. We're still navigating through this new world, and how that will shake out will take some time. Of course, you know, this has been a pendulum. Our parents and grandparents formed unions generations ago before there was any collective bargaining law. And the reasons that they join unions are the same reasons that today's workers will seek to form unions. That is to speak with one voice, to advocate for their profession in public education, and to protect their collective interests. Those core values remain, whether there's a law or not. And the divisions come about where there are forward-thinking employers that value their asset that they have in their employees and the investment they make in their employees versus those that don't, or those who are simply looking at the bottom line and don't really care about the quality of education despite speaking in favor of it, that they would rather run out veteran teachers and bring in new untested teachers into the workforce.
And let's go next to John. John is joining us from Windsor. Hi, John.
Hi. Well, you know, I'm a state employee as well, and I think that the previous caller is absolutely right about the disrespect. You know, we supposedly have merit bonuses. That's a joke. The merit bonuses go to only certain segments of employees. You know, we have no idea when the next foot's going to drop. You know, what I've seen is like rats jumping off a sinking ship. We have so many people that are leaving state employment that, you know, we wanted to work in service and provide services, but, you know, they no longer feel that they can, and they're replaced by people who don't really know what they're doing. And nothing negative about new employees, but, you know, when you lose that institutional kind of thing, you have kids that are doing contracts that don't have any experience, and it's taking so much more time and so much more money, and for what? You know, it just really is very disappointing.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call and the thoughts, John. And Jack, what would you say to that?
I agree. There is this uncertainty that exists among many employees, certain employers, where they no longer can predict what's going to happen to them. They live in fear of unfair and arbitrary treatment by supervisors, and they do not understand how decisions with respect to pay and other work employment decisions are being made. With a contract, those criteria are essentially spelled out. People know how decisions are going to be made, and there's a process of redress if they disagree with what decisions that are made. Now, in many instances, with handbooks that provide a paltry amount of protections without due process, a lot of employees are working in fear.
Jack, if other districts could follow the template that you described in Racine based on, it sounded like, mutual respect and collaboration, do you think that the benefits, as Governor Walker would see them, to Act 10 would be more palatable to people?
Well, it depends on what Governor Walker's intended benefits were. From his perspective, I suspect Act 10 was designed simply for union busting. It wasn't a budget fix in any sense of the way. And I think that it has failed. Employees are choosing to belong to unions, even if it's in smaller numbers. Our membership is smaller. But there is still great support and strong support for unions. I think the best example is the recent recertification elections that were imposed by Act 10 for school district employees this past December. You know, over 56,000 school district employees were covered by those elections. Nearly 70% of all eligible voters participated. And of those who voted, 98% voted for union certification. I mean, this is decisive support, and that occurred despite the faulty and unfair conditions of the election. So, you know, support for unions remains strong. Employees want a voice, and they're going to have a voice.
How do you expect some of what happened in the past with Act 10 to play out in the coming elections?
I think there's still great frustration about the governor's policies, Act 10 being among them, that I think people are motivated I know that from our members on the ground that they're more engaged now because of what's happened under Act 10. They're more plugged into elections. They're more plugged into what's happening in their profession, and they're fighting to preserve it and to protect it and to improve it.
Jack, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
That was Jack Bernfeld, Uniserv Director for WEAC Capital South Region. He joined us as part of our coverage of the third anniversary of Act 10.
You've probably heard of the hit TV show Mad Men. It tells the story of ad agencies working in New York's Madison Avenue back in the 1960s. It's filled with cigarettes, booze, sex, and swagger.
The show has been criticized, though, for its lack of diversity. It excludes African Americans from the advertising scene of the 1960s in New York. Matthew Weiner, the show's director, says that's just historical reality.
But one Milwaukee-based graphic designer says that just isn't the case, and that African Americans were part of the New York advertising scene in the 60s. Mad Men rubbed Xavier Ruffin the wrong way from the beginning, and although he wanted to like it, he just couldn't.
And so he created a new web series called Mad Black Men. It satirizes black representation in Mad Men. Let's listen to a clip.
We have here black man with a briefcase on Madison Avenue. That's a strange sight to see. Oh, not one but two colored men in suits. This could be interesting.
I see you have a briefcase. You work in this building?
I used to. 12th floor.
So what happened?
They fired me because they said I look angry too much.
Being a mad man doesn't mean you have to be angry.
But that doesn't stop me from being a mad black man. Now, excuse me. I have people to sue.
Xavier Ruffin joins us now.
Xavier, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, I want to know, what was your first impression the very first time you watched Mad Men?
The very first time I watched Mad Men, I think I remember the scene where Don is in a bar of some sort, and he's asking his waiter about what type of cigarettes he smokes. And his waiter happens to be black, and it's interrupted by one of the bar owners, and the bar owner asks Don, like, is this man bothering you? I can make him go away. And so that was, like, literally one of the first scenes I ever saw from Mad Men. And it was kind of, I won't say heartbreaking because it's not unexpected, but it was a show that I really wanted to like. Because a lot of my peers, I'm being a graphic designer and a designer, a lot of my peers love the show, and I wanted to get into it, but there are certain barriers that I just wasn't interested in seeing, and I wasn't fond of the way that African Americans were portrayed in the show, so I just decided to not watch it. And that was until a couple of years ago, because the show had consistently been getting flack for how it portrayed African Americans in the design field, and the show's creator took to the defense that there were no black people in design.
Right, and that's been how he responds, the creator, Matt Weiner, when he's critiqued for not including more black characters. He said, well, it was the 60s, and there weren't that many African-American men in advertising, and therefore that's what's reflected on the show. How do you respond to that?
Well, I'd say that there were. There weren't a great lot of them, so I'm not going to pretend like at every firm, if you walked in, you would see a bunch of them. But there were definitely more than one or two. Excuse me. I just spent the whole of Black History Month hosting real-life black men and women from the 60s who worked on Madison Avenue or in advertising, and I think we listed over 30 of them just every day of the month. And there are several of them that were very high-profile. The first person that comes to mind is always George Olden, because George Olden was a vice president at McCann Erickson in 1962, which I think is the year that the show started. And that would technically make George Olden more important than Don Draper. And he also designed the Clio Award that Don won, and he also won it way more times than Don won it. So it's not like black people could not exist in that universe, because they did. So to say that they simply don't exist is kind of like a cop-out, just so that they could paint the picture that they wanted to paint, which was sans African-Americans.
So you think that Matt Weiner, he could have put African-Americans in there. It's not to say that they didn't exist at all, that he went too far.
Well, yeah, it's just that wasn't the picture that he wanted to paint, is what I believe. And as an artist, I can understand that. He might have felt that, you know, bringing in that black element would change the way that the story is, the path of the story, because it's really about, you know, these white privileged men and how they move and the things that they can get away with. But at the same time, they do, you know, open the doors to, like, the women's struggle in the workplace and their fight for equality. So it's not like they didn't want to tell an equality story. It's just that they didn't want to do the race one.
Well, you decided to take matters into your own hands, and you've created a show of your own called Mad Black Men. Can you tell us how you came up with that?
Yeah, that actually started a few years ago now. I was working on a sketch comedy show with a few friends of mine from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and we were just throwing out a bunch of ideas of little sketches, and Mad Black Men came up, you know, just, you know, what does it mean if you flip the madman world upside down and put some, you know, assertive black people into it, and, like, kind of what would happen. And then the idea kind of just organically grew over time. I worked on it a little bit when I was applying for master's degrees, and I ended up going to South by Southwest in 2012 and pitching the idea to Roman Thomason from Daily Motion, and he told me that they had a funding program coming up and that I should submit the idea for it there, and they gave us the funding. So,
and what is it about? Tell us what your version of the advertising world with black people looks like.
Well, our version is kind of a satirical parody, kind of a dramedy, where it's just looking at that Mad Men world through a different lens, from the vantage point of three black ad workers who are trying to survive, keep a certain level of dignity, and still follow orders at work. So they may have some very racially insensitive campaigns come through their door that they're expected to work on, so they have to come up with ideas without trying to compromise themselves and their own personal identities too much, but still deliver something for the client that's going to be pleasing. But we do it with a little bit of a stick and a little bit of laughter. So,
and your main character, obviously a take on Don Draper, is Ron Rapper, and I want to get to him in just a minute. But first, I want to ask you about sort of the tone of the show. In one of the scenes from your show, there are two black men in suits and briefcases, and they're kind of checking each other out at the elevator lobby. And one of them says he got fired for looking too angry. And there's that, and the title of the show itself, Mad Black Men. Is that part of the commentary you're going for here, a swipe at the trope of the angry black man?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. I mean, that's part of what it is. I've been that guy before, and by that guy, I mean, there's the idea of the token black guy, and so I forget what other movie that was in, but there was kind of like a token black guy at a party, and then another token black guy came to the party, and they kind of had the, like, yo, I'm the token black guy here today, and the other one had to leave. So, I mean, there's all kinds of different dynamics when it comes to playing with race and what does it mean to be black surrounded by, you know, non-black, and where does solidarity come into play. But, yeah, we definitely wanted to look at what does it mean to be, you know, like this angry black man. Are you actually angry, or do you just appear angry to other people because they don't know you? Are you frustrated? So, yeah, we're trying to play with a lot of different things.
Well, you're a graphic designer yourself. Does your own experience, does that come through in the series too?
Yeah, I did the title credits for the series. I use it for reference when writing different pitches that you'll see later on in the series. So it does play a pretty big role in how the series is developed.
And let's go back to your main character here in Mad Black Men, Ron Rapper. Tell us about him. Who is he?
Well, Ron's an up-and-coming hotshot art director in New York City. He makes really, really good work. So people are getting to know his work. But he also has a reputation for a short temper. So it's not that he's not militant at all, but he's very assertive and tends to stand for himself a lot. But this also causes him to lose jobs fairly quickly. So he's kind of going through something with his significant other, and she's basically in his ear telling him that if he gets fired again, she's going to leave. So now Ron's stuck in this predicament where he would normally assert himself and say what he isn't going to stand for. Now he has to kind of suppress those feelings. So that adds to his own angers and frustrations.
I know you've got a lot of series planned, or a lot of the episodes planned out, so we'll be watching for those. And I want to ask you, your series is set in the 60s, like Mad Men, but discrimination in the workplace hasn't gone anywhere. It's still present in some places. In Wisconsin in particular, it struggles with stark racial disparity. How do you think Ron Rapper would be treated today at an advertising firm, say in Milwaukee?
I think that it would be it'd be different as far as the tone that people would take with one another. And the lack of representation is still very real. I think part of it is due to lack of opportunity, more so than flat-out racial discrimination. I think a lot of the minority community hasn't been exposed to the idea of design, graphic design, and advertising as a profession. I like to point out programs like the Marcus Graham Project that help facilitate that and help try to place people into jobs and internships, different minorities into jobs and internships, and teach them about the profession. But, yeah, the representation hasn't gotten too much better. But I don't think it's just blatant, we don't like black people here, so we don't hire them, as much as we don't know, or we're not looking for black people to work with us because we don't know any good ones. Not that they don't exist, they're all over the place. It's just how do we get the word out, and how do we promote ourselves to these different companies to get hired?
Xavier, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you again for having me.
That was Xavier Ruffin. He created a web series called Mad Black Men. He's a Milwaukee-based graphic designer. You can check out the premiere of the series on the Central Time Facebook page.
It is time for a weekly state news roundup. Noah Ovshinsky joins us now. He is the assistant news director here at WPR.
Noah, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Veronica.
Well, let's start by taking a look at a would-be law that's been kicking around the courts for a while, the controversial voter ID law. Where
yes.
are we on that one?
So as we get closer to the end of the legislative session, which is just in a few weeks here, and closer to the election season, the issue of voter ID has resurfaced. This week, it's resurfaced primarily because Governor Walker said this week that he would be willing to call a special session to modify the existing law should there be a ruling in either the state or federal courts that you just referred to. The law is currently being challenged by the NAACP and the League of Women Voters.
And what sorts of things could be done? I understand Governor Walker is talking about changes that might be made to keep the law from being struck down. What is he looking at?
You're right. So one of the other interesting things that happened this week was Governor Walker said, really acknowledged that lawyers at the Department of Justice here in Wisconsin feel the tweaks do need to be made to the current law in order for them to be upheld or I guess in this case, to prevent them from being struck down by the courts. And there are a few tweaks, they are actually – those tweaks are already included in legislation that's passed the assembly. And basically what it does is it allows voters who don't have IDs to sign affidavits at the polls attesting to their identity. These tweaks have been done in other states like Indiana where voter ID laws have been challenged. The state Senate has not voted on that bill. The leaders in that chamber are waiting to see what happens in the courts. They feel the assembly version weakens the law too much, and so they haven't voted on it yet.
And so if this tweak does happen, allowing voters to sign affidavits at the polls saying they are who they say they are, what sort of circumstances would allow for a person to sign an affidavit?
Right. So under the bill that's in the assembly right now, or I should say that passed the assembly, allows somebody to vote without an ID if they attest to the fact that they're too poor to get an ID, if they have religious objections to showing an ID, or if the voter can't produce the documents they needed in order to get that ID.
So this has been, as we know, a hotly debated law in Wisconsin.
Huge.
And not just
yeah.
Wisconsin, around the country. What are the flashpoints to watch among critics and supporters?
Yeah, voter ID laws are one of those things that have really surfaced in the last few years especially, and they are very controversial. Supporters of voter ID across the country and here in Wisconsin say that the requirement that somebody must show an ID at the polls, it ensures the integrity of the elections. It makes sure that the elections are fair and that there isn't fraud. Critics, of which there are many, say that, you know, this is essentially a solution in search of a problem. They say voter fraud isn't really an issue, and that, in fact, the effort to require an ID at the polls is really an effort to suppress mainly Democratic voters in largely urban areas, people who aren't as or are less likely to have IDs.
And this is one to watch. Governor Walker has said he wants this in place by the next election, right?
Right. That, of course, that's one of the things. That's why there is something of a timeline here. The governor and I'm sure others would like to have this law in place by then. Of course, we'll have to see whether or not we'll have to see what the courts have to say. And then we'll have to see what the Senate and the Assembly have to say once those rulings come down.
All right. Well, there was also some movement on other election-related bills this week. Let's start with proposed changes to absentee voting. How would the bill modify the way absentee voting takes place here in Wisconsin?
All right. So continuing on this election theme this week, a few bills moved through the legislature. The Senate passed a controversial bill that prohibits in-person absentee voting on weekends and also puts a cap on the number of hours a clerk can have in-person absentee voting during the work week. Under the bill, early voting would only be done upwards of 45 hours a week.
And who does this largely affect here?
Right. So this largely affects Madison and Milwaukee, both areas that have a lot of early voting. There are a lot of people who take advantage of weekend hours, a lot of people who take advantage of the extended hours during the weekday. You know, supporters, including many Democrats, who, at least in Madison and in Milwaukee, a lot of these voters, you know, they vote Democratic. The supporters say, you know, that a robust early voting system, it takes into account the realities of people's schedules these days. You know, they argue that the traditional 9-to-5 job for many people is a thing of the past. Supporters of the bill, people who'd like to see early voting shrunk, say that, you know, having generous early voting is unfair to rural communities who may not have the resources to have a lot of early voting. So for Republicans in the legislature, this bill essentially levels the playing field.
And there was, as I said, motion in both in the absentee voting and where are we with that right now?
Right. So the early voting bill now heads to the assembly. So we'll see where that goes.
And looking at another story here, this one not so hotly contested. Hot is the wrong word, in fact. Icy is a better word. The ice caves in
well
Lake
played.
Superior.
Well played.
So these have been getting national attention not just national, international attention as stories and pictures have gone viral. Tell us what's going on with the ice caves up north.
Right. So on a slightly lighter and somewhat sad note, I have to say, the ice caves near Cornucopia are closing no later than Sunday. As of right now, they are open, but they will be open no longer than Sunday evening. And, you know, it's one of those situations where, you know, this turned out to be a big story for Wisconsin. 100,000 people have visited these ice formations since January. That's a lot of people. In fact, the single day record was reached last Saturday when 14,000 people visited the caves. The previous single day record was 11,000. You know, this has just been a great story for Wisconsin, you know, because it's been certainly great for the local economy in northern Wisconsin. And it's made, you know, national and international headlines. It's really put the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, it's really brought up to the forefront.
And Wisconsin Public Radio is at the vanguard of that story,
yes,
right?
Yes, we have covered this story extensively. We've tracked the numbers of people who have visited. We've done a Wisconsin Life. We've talked about it on the talk shows. I would urge anybody who hasn't seen pictures of these ice caves to go to our website right now or go on Facebook and look for the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore page and look at photos of these caves. They're gorgeous, and they're not going to last long.
All right. Noah, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica.
Noah Ovshinsky is WPR's assistant news director. He joins us every week at this time to look at what's making news in Wisconsin.
Now we're continuing our nod to Wisconsin musicians playing at the South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin. We've been playing their songs throughout the show. So far we've heard from the bands Fox, Vic and Gab, and Hugh Bob and The Hustle.
Right now we'll hear a song from Milwaukee-born and based artist Classic. He plays the jazz saxophone, and his music focuses on positive messages. He was named Solo Artist of the Year at the 88.9 Radio Milwaukee Music Awards. This song is called Boogie, based on a cover of Michael Jackson's Blame It on the Boogie.
All right. Well, all right. Side to side. It's cool because it's like side. All right. Well, everybody, come on. We party to the sunshine. Then we wake up in the moonlight. We can have a good time. Everybody boogie. We party to the sunshine.